everybody. Thank you so much for joining us here on the Transportation and Logistics Podcast, powered by Atlanta Dispatch and Humblebee Enterprises. I am very excited to be here with a special guest. We have Kevin Jennings, who is a government contractor and the owner of Jennings Engineering and Construction. And before we begin, I just wanted to say that The Dispatcher's Guide to the Galaxy is available now as an ebook and a physical book. You can acquire your copy online via Barnes and Juneteenth. Became a federal holiday in 2021. And for those who are unfamiliar, an abridged recap of the holiday's origin is on June 19th, 1865, about 2 months after the Confederate, probably about 2.5 years earlier, on January 1st, 1863, by President Abraham Lincoln. So that's the abridged history got to Juneteenth. Brother, thank you so much for joining me. How did you learn of Juneteenth? Was it something that you got in school, or was it, how did you come about hearing about Juneteenth?
Originally learned about it in school. I went to high school in Atlanta, Georgia. So I learned a lot about the Civil War and just about everything like that in school. Kind of, sadly enough, kind of like late in life, because I went to my early years of schooling in Florida, and it was a topic that we literally never spoke of. So when I became aware of just all things about that in high school, it was pretty good to me. It was interesting to learn about it. So I'd say high school is when I learned about it all.
Okay. Well, no, that's dope, man. I'm not going to lie to you. I really enjoyed history when I was in the earlier schooling, and I don't remember this being covered at all. And I attended Georgia State University, and I even took an African-American studies class. And I don't know if I heard about it then, but it was definitely something that just started coming up in my friend group, you know. So just the words started coming around, and eventually I got up to game on it. But it took me a long time, too. I was later in life before I found out and actually learned the history and understood what it exactly meant. So I'm happy that we were able to get this bad boy locked in as a federal holiday. So shout out to President Joe Biden. But yeah, I've been having a great day so far, and I pray you have as well, man. For those who have not been introduced to you in the past, I'll just say, give us a little bit about your background. Like, introduce yourself, if you will.
Yeah, so thanks. Once again, name's Kevin Jennings. I have been a government contractor since 2009. Basically, the abridged version of the story was I was in the real estate field from 2004 to 2007, early 2008. And then when the market crashed, like most people, I was kind of left without anything. And one of those things being a career. And so I got introduced to government contracting. And once I learned, you know, what it was and how I could utilize the government to basically not only create a income for myself and others, but as a way to build wealth, I latched onto it and have been doing that ever since then. And then in 2022, we created the Government Cheese, which is an educational platform that teaches other business owners how to take their skills and market them to the government. And so for the past year and a half, that's been my personal mission, is trying to teach as many individuals as I can what government contracting is and how they can use the government to grow their business the same way that I was able to.
Oh, I love it, man. I definitely love it. And although it wasn't my era, you know, just one generation back, I'm pretty sure my family knew what that government cheese tasted like. So I love the name, brother. Look, do you specialize in anything in the government contracting space?
So in my particular business, it's the construction space, but from the educational side with Government Cheese, we help people in every industry. But a bulk of my career has been spent in the construction space.
Okay. You know, some would say that we're in the microwave era, you know, the social media highlight era where one instant success, instant gratification. How much goes into making a company ready and able to participate in the government contracting space? Or is it something that somebody just can come up off the street and participate in?
Yeah, it's definitely not an easy process. I think that's why for so long, a lot of people stayed away from government contracting because, you know, getting registered, getting certified, it's not easy. It's definitely not microwave. It does take some effort. But it's not something that people can't do. And that's kind of what we want to do, is show people that it's something that you can definitely do it. There are a lot of resources out there, especially for small minority businesses. There's a lot of resources out there, whether it be through the SBA or the MBDA or the PTAX. There's a lot of money that the government spends to basically teach people and help people. The biggest problem that I see is that we don't know that these resources exist, right? So that's what keeps people back from doing everything, is the lack of resources.
Right. Yeah, and I definitely want to touch on that a little bit more, just about those resources, you know, especially that educational piece and how the government will invest into its contractors. Look, I'm going to say something. I want you to just give me, you know, how do you feel about it? The government provides hand ups, not handouts. How do you feel about that statement?
Yeah, it's 100% true. That's honestly, that's what government contracting is centered around. But for so long, so many people got used to receiving handouts from the government that they don't know how to tell the difference. And so they think that, you know, the government's supposed to just give them everything. As it relates to, like, government contracting specific, they're not going to give you a handout. They will give you a hand up. And I will say that there are a lot of opportunities where the government is giving hand ups, but people just don't see it, and they want a handout. And that's not what's going to happen. The government is definitely not going to give out handouts.
Again, this discussion is entitled Getting to the Government Cheese, and it is to cover the full cycle of the government contract. When you were entering the industry, you know, what would you say the largest barriers of entry were when you pivoted from the real estate market to government contracting?
So for me at that time, honestly, it was the education piece, because this was, you know, 2008. So there was no YouTube, you know, Google wasn't what it is today. There were no educational resources for me. I had to basically go to the SBA office. I couldn't, you know, send an email. I had to go to the SBA office, you know, try to get on someone's calendar, meet with them so they could explain to me the different certification programs, explain to me how to research contracts. So the education was, that was the biggest barrier of entry for me.
Okay. Like you said in the beginning, you know, a lot of people just don't know the process. They don't know about the resources and they don't know the steps. So since you've built a community, the government cheese, and you've been pouring your energy, your time into it, you've gotten to know, you know, lots and lots and lots of different people on their journey to government contracting. Have you learned that there are any other barriers that they're facing, or are they pretty much the same thing?
So education is a big one. And the second biggest one I would say right now is the access to capital.
Okay.
Just don't know where to go for good funding. And, they get scared when they hear government contracting, because they think, oh, you know, the government doesn't pay well, I don't have money, I can't risk doing that type of work. But in actuality, it goes back to the resources, and there's actually more money available for government contractors than there are regular businesses.
Definitely want to touch on that a little bit more later in this discussion, just because that's a huge thing. Why go through the process of getting yourself ready, willing, and able, and then not be able to fund it? You got to be able to fund the project, because, you know, they're not giving the money up front. Yeah, but no, we're going to get there. As far as the, but sometimes it's a little bit daunting, even overwhelming at times, to look at a solicitation to say, you know, how do I even read this? How do I know what I just read? How do I understand what is being asked for, and, you know, the parameters in which you are being required to say you can perform these tasks? Like, do you have any advice on for those who are reading solicitations and they find it difficult to comprehend?
Yeah, what I tell all my students up front is don't overthink it. It's the government. It's easy. But what they do is they'll put all these big words and all these sheets of paper in front of you to try to frustrate you and deter you from doing it. But the biggest thing is don't overthink it. Answer the questions specifically as they ask them. The beautiful thing about the government is there can be no ambiguity in a solicitation. Like, it has to, the same way I read it is the same way that you should read it. And if the solicitation isn't written in that way, then that's grounds for it to be thrown out. So because it's so simple, you kind of got to go to it and think about it on a simple level. Like, literally don't overthink anything about it. And a lot of people do. They'll pick up a solicitation and it's 150 pages and then they get overwhelmed because the first three pages are all these government forms and they have all these codes and laws and it just, it's a lot. It's a lot when you look at it. But once you learn what pages you need to actually read, what keywords you need to look for, the stuff is actually very simple because it has to be.
Right, right. And, you know, I know it's a lot to really ask you to really say how to get that game without going through the 10,000 hours of actually reading solicitations. But any tips or tricks how you can actually know which pages to read and which words that should be keened in on?
Yeah, for sure. So basically, when you look at a solicitation, like I said, most of these large solicitations are going to be, you know, 100 pages. But the reality is the first 10 to 15% of the solicitation is all you need to worry about. The other 85 to 90% of the solicitation is going to be standardized forms. So that's going to be all your disclosures and things like that. So really the first 10 to 15%, or if it's a 100 page document, the first 10 to 15 pages, that's the whole meat and potatoes of the actual solicitation. The rest of it is all just generic stuff that's in every solicitation. So once you pull out that first 10 to 15% and you're working with the true meat and potatoes of the solicitation, you got to also understand that the first 1 to 3 pages are going to be your standard forms, which are going to be your SFs. So if it's a SF-42 or SF-49, that's just the standardized form that the solicitation is written on. So once you see that, those first couple pages, you're going to pull those to the side. And then you want to focus on literally that good 7 to call it pages in the middle. That's going to be your statement of work. That's going to be your price proposal. That's going to be all of your determining factors for your proposal if it's a RFP. Everything you need is really between pages 12 and 15. And that's the big trick, is just don't get overwhelmed by the rest. Just go straight to those pages right there. Right. Pages, like I said, 3 to 15.
Okay. Now, that's great advice right there. Thank you so much. You've been in this space a while now. You've seen all types of sides of it. How competitive is government contracting right now?
It's honestly not competitive at all. Mm. The number of certified small businesses is decreasing by about 5% every year. So it actually gets easier every year. And as far as competition, I've never seen a bid that had more than 5 people bid on it. Typically, you're going to see like 2 to 3 people, because 3 people is what they need for competition. So typically, you're going to see right around that 3 people. You're never going to be bidding against 10 other contractors, no matter what it is, construction, IT, healthcare, janitorial. It's just, there's not that many people in the space. And to be honest with you, there's more projects out there than there are people. So there's enough for everybody.
Okay. No, I love that, man, because you think about transportation in the traditional spot market fashion, there's super competition. There's always a broker that is looking for a carrier who will take the load for less. And a carrier, I hate to say this, a lot of times they're willing to take the load for $15, $20, $50 less than another carrier just to make sure that they get it. So it's a race to the bottom for the carrier. But you're saying in this space, it's enough. It's enough for everybody. It makes me think. I hear a lot about solicitations that only have one response. As a result, the one company that did respond, if they can meet the needs, they probably won the bid. Do you hear about that type of stuff frequently? And have you kind of been able to say it happens more frequently in a specific industry, if you have been hearing about it so much?
No, it happens all the time. I wouldn't say it's specific to any industry. It's across the board. It happens in every industry. That's why I teach my students to always bid your price. Don't ever try to chase a bid. Don't ever go in and think, okay, I really want this, so I'm going to go 20% lower than I normally would. No, You always want to bid your price because you never know. And it happens a lot where people are the only ones that bid and they just basically walk away with jobs. It happens more frequently than not, to be honest with you. And then I was talking to some people last week when I was in Tampa. I was meeting with a guy and he was having an issue because he was bidding some stuff and consistently he was the only one. And so the agency basically stopped awarding because they were like, they needed to increase competition. And so they had one job where they literally just kept putting it out and he was the only one that responded. But the agency was, they were trying to increase competition. So they've been going back and forth trying to get more people to bid and they can't. So he's just walking away with work. But he's ended up having to bid every time, like 2 and 3 times because the agency will reject the bid because they're like, well, there's got to be more people. So then they'll put it back out. Nobody bids. They'll put it back out. Nobody bids. So then they just give it to him. And so he's able to basically name his price because there's no competition.
Oh, I love it. You know, let me ask you this. How important is it to gather market research before deciding where in government contracting you want to specialize? How important is that?
Now, market research is everything because you got to think the benefit we have in being government contractors is we have access to all the data. So we know how the government spends money. So we can go back 10 years and we can see what agencies spend how much within our industry. And then we can even go and we can look at their procurement forecast for the next, you know, 12, 18, 24 months. And we can see all the projects that they have lined out that they already have money pulled down from Congress and where they're going to spend it at. So we can put a plan together to be successful. There's no other business that allows that capability. Every other business, we're hoping that we get a customer and we're hoping that that customer, you know, has a lot of volume. Our customer in the federal government, we know for certain every year how much volume they have. And then because for them to pull down their budget from Congress, they have to go to Congress with projects already earmarked and say, this year we want to spend, you know, $15 billion on transportation and we're going to spend it in this state, this state. And these are the transportation projects we want to do. They have to bring that to Congress. So then you as the person in the industry, you don't have to figure anything out. If you do your market research, then you know, okay, they're going to spend $50 billion this year in transportation. Here's 5 projects that they're going to do. And then here's the agencies and the contacts for each person at that agency. And all you got to do is call that person and say, hey, I'm able to do this job. Let me know when it's available.
Right, right. Man, and the funny thing is, I want to ask you another question, but I've been able to peruse the US DOT, US Department of Transportation's website to actually look at that procurement forecast. You know what I mean? Yep. And just like you just said, once you find something, I mean, they make it very searchable. It is so easy to search and based on whatever certifications, whatever agency, the amount, so many different things they allow you to put in the search parameters. Once you actually click on it, the name is there, email, sometimes phone number.
Yeah. Oh, so yeah.
It's wild. But here's the funny thing. This is what happened the other day. I did that same exact thing, right? I called the brother who was listed and he was just so shocked that his information was out there like that. I was like, man, I don't know what to tell you, but yeah, that's the process. It's available if you're wanting to do the research on the procurement opportunities that are coming up.
And that's honestly, that's why I love it. That's why when I got into it, I haven't switched industries in 15 years because when I realized how easy this was and that all you had to do was do a little planning, put a little game plan together and basically just follow the plan, I was like, why am I going out here running, you know, ads and trying to find customers and cold calling people, asking them to please hire me for work. Like, why am I doing that? Like, you know, you even think about like in the transportation industry, you know, you're on the load board, you're searching and you're worrying about people undercutting. And then this carrier has a deal with this broker. And so he gets all the preferred loads. And then it's so much. It's like, why am I fighting? Like, what is the point?
Right, right. Now I hear you, brother. I hear you. You say that you got to do this research before you decide that you're going to get into government contracting. Where can they get this information? Where can we find this market research so that we can educate ourselves on what the trends are?
Yeah, so there's a couple sites that I utilize. One of them is going to be usaspending.gov. Usaspending.gov is a very easy to navigate site. It basically tracks spending of the government. So you can track down to the penny every dollar that the government spent in any given year. And so you have all of the data there. So that's one of the great places to go. Another one is going to be FPDS. So FPDS is very much like USA Spending. You can track stuff all the way down. And on FPDS, you can even see, you know, purchase orders and stuff like that. And then one of the last ones is going to be acquisition.gov. Acquisition.gov is where you can go for all of those procurement forecasts. And that's where you'll be able to see exactly who's going to sell what in the upcoming year. So those are the main three that I use for market research. Of course, you know, the big one, SAM.gov, that's what most people know of because that's the one that everybody talks about. But I teach people, don't even go to SAM.gov until you're really ready to rock and roll. You need to spend most of your time on those other three sites first.
Just mindset, right? Somebody who is preparing their mindset to even know how to navigate these sites. Like, what are they really looking to do when they go to these sites? How are they searching? How are they making the most of the information that they have access to?
Yeah, so what you want to be doing is you want to be searching based on your NICE code, so your North American Industry Standard Classification. You want to be searching based on that. So whatever it is that you your business does that you specialize in, you want to put that NICE code into like USA Spending, and you want to see what agencies spend money on the services that you provide. You can even break it down by state. You can start to filter it by a set aside type. But that's essentially what you want to do is you want to figure out who has your money, who's buying what it is that you sell. And then you same thing on FPDS. And then once you have all that information and you know who buys what you sell, then you're able to go on acquisition and you're able to pull up the forecast for those particular agencies. You know, there's over 200 agencies out there, but typically in any NICE code, you're going to have 3 to 5 agencies that spend within certain NICE codes. So you want to know what your top 5 actually looks like for you.
Gotcha. No, that's great information. And for those who have never even had an opportunity to find your, your NICS codes, you know, people say it so many different ways, but you know what we're talking about. You can just go, you can search them. You can look them up. You can go to the website. You can go to NAICS.com, you know, go there and start perusing if this is so early into the process that you have not identify what codes you would be operating under. But you know, the whole point is to find where that money is going, because although it might not be something that you've already identified as your core competency, you know, people learn stuff every day and they can position themselves to take advantage of the market after they know where they should be putting their time and their energy. And again, let's talk through the full cycle of a government contract. What is the first phase of the cycle, brother?
Yeah, so the first phase of anything is going to be that planning phase. So that's the when the government's actually doing market research. So that's going to be through things like sources sought and requests for information. So those sources sought and RFIs, that's what the government's going to do where they're doing their own market research. So they're trying to figure out what firms are even in the market that can do the work that they need. Once they identify that firms are out there, then they're going to go into a pre-solicitation phase. So this is kind of this time where they're putting it out to the public to let you know, hey, we have this job coming out. This is the set aside type that we want to do it under. This is the NICE code that we want to procure it under as well. And here's the magnitude of the project. And then after that, it will go into the actual solicitation phase. And then once it comes out of solicitation phase, then it'll be an actual, you know, awarded contract and people will be working on it.
Okay, cool. Now, I appreciate you going through that cycle, brother. And, you know, how can participating in the pre-solicitation actually set you apart from other contractors?
Yeah, so I tell people, that beginning phase, that sources sought, that RFI, and that pre-solicitation phase, that's where you really want to spend most of your time. Because when we talk about things like very limited competition, that's when they determine what type of competition is out there. So if you're letting the government know that you exist, that you're ready to do this type of work, there is opportunities for them to set aside the work, for them to sole source the work to you. So you want to definitely be a part of the sources saw it, the RFI and the pre-solicitation process. You want them to know that you exist, because our job at the end of the day as government contractors is to make the government's life easier. That's what we got to remember. There's somebody who's working in the government whose job is to get this project done no matter what it is. All we want to do is make that person's life easier. So if that means if we can 90 days from putting it on SAM, nobody's going to bid, by telling them we're the only one that's going to bid, they're going to go with that, right? So being a part of that, to answer your question, is so, so very important, because that's how you can get ahead of some of the work.
Gotcha. Now that makes perfect sense, brother. Makes perfect sense. Thank you so much for sharing that. Do you have any go-to certifications that you encourage the members of the government cheese to get?
Oh, man. I mean, every female in our program, I tell them, you know, you have to be a certified woman-owned business. There are a lot of women who are in business, but there are very few women-owned businesses. So that's the first one. If you're a female, you have to get the woman-owned cert. It's going to open up so much opportunity to you. The next big one is going to be veterans. There's very few veteran-owned firms that are out there. There's a lot of vets. I tell every vet, even if you don't know what you want to do, go get your cert, because it will open you up for a world of opportunity, specifically with the Veterans Administration, with the Defense. They have such large goals and initiatives as it relates to veteran spending that you're doing yourself a disservice by not having a cert. So those are going to be the two big ones that I push. The big daddy of them all, like everybody knows, is the 8A certification. But I tell everybody in all of my programs, if you're not ready, if you haven't been in this game 2 to 3 years and you're not already making, you know, 60-70% of what your NICE code is, you don't want to waste your time with 8A. Is the granddaddy of a minor certification. And essentially the purpose of that certification is to take you from being a small business to a large business. So that's not just life-changing, but that's family-changing. I understand, but the government has literally given us a tool to build generational wealth, but we don't use it at all. And so that's going to be your most powerful cert, is your 8A. But now my favorite certification, which is a sleeper, is the Hub Zone.
Okay.
I love the Hub Zone cert. And the reason I love the Hub Zone cert is because there's only 2,800 certified Hub Zone companies in the world. And so when you look at the number of dollars that are set aside or that could possibly be set aside for Hub Zone firms versus the number of firms that are certified, it's staggering. The ratios are staggering.
Right.
So that is my personal favorite. And Hub Zone is one of those ones where it doesn't matter what sex you are. It doesn't matter your socioeconomic status. It's truly based on where your business is located and what are you doing for the neighborhoods that your business is located in. And so that one, I laugh when I say this, but like I have students that are, you know, 45-year-old white males from Kansas, and they're like, well, there's no certification for me. You know, this is only set up for women or minorities or veterans. And I was like, no, there is literally a certification made for a 45-year-old white male, and it is the Hub Zone certification. But they know, nobody knows that it exists or how to utilize it. So that is my personal favorite of all of them, just because of the lack of competition.
Something that I found out that I had to get, man. I had to get it. I was in the area that was underutilized for this business, and I said, let me just go ahead and put that groundwork in, because why not? I'm trying to put myself in as many buckets to get set aside awards as possible, you know. So I think that I definitely agree with your mindset and the way that you are directing your students. If you're in that spot where you can get, have you noticed or, you know, heard that folks who do have their certifications kind of show up feeling a little bit entitled, like maybe they should be winning the solicitation just because they have a certification versus it being the cherry on top of what they already are offering?
Yeah, I mean, that goes back to what we were talking about earlier, the handout versus the hand up. Like, having a certification doesn't mean that you're just going to walk into places and get work. Like, you have to build a good business. You have to, you know, be doing exactly what you say you can do. You need to have all your stuff together. And then, like you say, the certification is just a cherry on top. But people do, they'll say, oh, I got my 8A, just give me work. But you can't, you have no experience. You haven't done anything. You have no financial capacity. You don't have any good subs. You don't have any good vendor relationships, but you got a certification. So it's like, okay, so what, who cares? So yeah, people do it all the time. But it goes back to the education, and no fault of the SBAs or any of those organizations. But the problem is when you go to help, the first thing they tell you is, okay, go get 8A and it'll be. So they're pushing people to get these certifications, but not teach how to utilize certification.
I agree with you as well. I tell people, do not get that 8A, man. Don't get the 8A until you're ready, because it's a shelf life. You only have it for so long. So if you're just out here, you know, barely trickling, you know what I mean, and you're not on full blast, don't waste your time, because you only have it for a certain amount of years. When it comes to contracting, right, what is the IDIQ? Like, what does it stand for? And, you know, what does it really mean in reference to government contracts?
Yeah, so an IDIQ stands for indefinite delivery, indefinite quantity. So IDIQs are some of the best contracts you can have, because they typically have a 4 or 5 or even a 10-year term, okay? And what happens with IDIQ is the government will set aside a pool of money, and they'll say, we have $20 million that we know we want to spend over the course of the next 4, 5, or 10 years, and we want to spend it within this service line. So instead of us having to create solicitations every time we have a job we want to be done, we're going to give a contract to XYZ firm, and then every time we need something, we're just going to write them a task order off of that IDIQ.
How will the government inform someone that they've actually won a contract? Like, what does that actually look like? What's that process look like? If I've gone through the pre-solicitation, I have submitted my solicitation, or I responded to the solicitation with what I got going on, how will they inform you that you've actually won?
Yeah, so when you do your SAM registration, you're going to input all of your different points of contact. So you can have a point of contact, an administrative point of contact, a financial point of contact. And so whenever something is done, contract is won, or an agency has a question, maybe looking at you for something, they'll reach to whatever point of contact you put on your SAM registration, which is another reason why you always want to make sure that your SAM registration is up to date.
Okay. So again, now we come back to that statement that you made earlier. Once the contract has been won, the hurdle of actually securing the funding to fulfill the requirements of the contract. All right, where can contractors get capital to mobilize and to get to working on the actual project? Like, where do you send your students? Like, and is this something that everybody can, participate in?
Yeah, so there's a number of different ways, but one of the best ways for government contractors is straight through the SBA. I mean, the Small Business Administration does lending, and they lend specifically to government contractors a lot. So there's a lot of opportunity right with the SBA.
Okay. So that means that you got to be communicating with the SBA long before you actually win the bid, correct?
Yeah, you want to, one of the main things you want to do when you first start business and you decide that this is what you want to do, you want to start reaching out to your local SBA offices. You want to reach out to all your local small business directors from all the different agencies you plan to work with. You want to start building relationships with them early, so that once you start winning work, you know that you exist. You don't want to wait till you got something and you need somebody. You know, the worst time to go to people for help is when you need them. So that's one of the things you want to do early on, is build those relationships.
Oh, I hear you, brother. And that's definitely a word right there. That's a principle. Definitely build your network before you need them. Build those networks before you need them, so that things can be a lot more seamless, because a lot of people already got their own stuff going on. So, you know, you bring in, more work to their plate, it just goes a lot easier if they already know you. So, okay. So we got the money, right? We've reached out to, we've actually submitted our bid price. We did all the research on the materials, on the labor, on everything that it takes to actually get the project completed. But now, you know, we're in a time, we're touching inflation. Inflationary costs are everywhere. You know, if this happens after I've already been awarded contract, does the government allow the contractor to adjust their prices to account for this inflationary cost?
That's a great question. And what I tell people is it goes back to what we were just talking about, the relationships. If you have a good relationship built with your client, and you are communicating with them throughout the entire process, then yes, sometimes they will. If you don't have a good relationship with them, then it can go the other way. When you do those IDIQs, you bid inflation into those IDIQs for those multi-year deals. But if it's a straight bid and you say, it happens a lot, like in my industry in construction, well, they'll have drawings that were created 2 years ago. And government estimate was done 2 years ago. Original bid was last year. By the time I get down to do it, you know, we're two and a half years from when they actually designed the project. Everything's changed. I can go back to them and say, hey, when we originally bid the drawings, here's the actual quotes that I got from my subs and my suppliers. Here's my quote today. And if you can show them that it's not something step on, or you trying to take advantage of them, they're very, very willing to work with you. Because remember, at the end of the day, you guys have to remember, the government wants you to make money. Why? So then you can pay taxes. If you're doing right. work and you're not making any money, they lose.
Right, right. No, that's a good point right there. And when you say the client, when you say make sure that you're building those relationships, is that the contract officer that we're really talking about here?
Yeah, it's building a relationship with a contract officer, building a relationship with the small business people. Because the small business department, we got to remember, in the government, the small business department, that's our advocate. That person is paid every year to basically look out for small businesses within certain agencies. So we got to make them do their job. They get paid a lot of money every year to make sure that we don't get taken advantage of as small businesses. So you right. build that relationship so they know that you exist.
And now we're talking about money. How do payments in the government work? Within the government contracting space, how do you get paid? What needs to happen in order for those payments to actually hit your account?
Yeah, so a lot of things is great, right? So we have the Prompt Payment Act. So under the Prompt Payment Act, as small businesses, you have to be paid within 15 days of an approved invoice. And then if you're doing stuff on a monthly payment situation, so say you get like a service contract where you're going to bill monthly, you'll get paid monthly. But typically, payment is very, very easy, 15 to 30 days. And actually, under the Prompt Payment Act, there's a prompt payment interest. So if the government doesn't pay you on time, you're actually able to charge the government interest for holding your money.
Okay.
So, payment is really not what people think it is. The problem, when you hear people say, you don't want to work for the government because the government doesn't pay, it's not the government that doesn't pay. What happens a lot of times is people will do work for other companies, and it'll be a government project, but they'll be working for a larger corporation. That larger corporation doesn't pay.
It's very rare that the government doesn't
pay. It's almost like in trucking, why you know, everybody wants factoring because they want to get paid now. It's not like they're not going to get paid. It's just they want to get paid today.
Right.
And so it's not like the customer is not paying for the load. It's just the customer is not paying right now. And so it happens the same way in government. It's not that the government's not paying. It's that it might take some time for the government to pay the prime, for then the prime to pay you as a sub. And a lot of times as small minority businesses, we're not even first tier subs. Sometimes we're second and third tier subs. So you got to think that money's got to transfer hands. And just like in trucking, nobody wants their own money on the line. Nobody right. wants risk. Because you got to, like, I was talking about this one day about transportation, like with trucking. She's like, why does this person have to factor? And then when you think about it, the only reason factoring exists in trucking because nobody wants to be liable. Nobody wants their own risk. It's the same thing in government contracting. Nobody wants to spend their own money. So when a prime's not going to pay you advance, he's going to say, oh no, you'll get paid whenever I get paid. So then it just flows downhill.
Right, right, right. And, you know, within transportation space, you know, we hear a lot about FEMA loads. And, you know, if there was a disaster and FEMA has to step in and get some products there, they're high paying freight. But most times, people do say they caution owner operators from taking the loads because of how long it's actually going to take to get paid, you know. So that's what I hear on the trucking side, working with the government. Go ahead.
So what it is, the reason that that exists, it's not that it takes a long time, but once again, so that owner operator is actually a third tier sub. So that means the money's got to pass through three other people before it gets to him. If that owner operator knew how to go direct to FEMA, they would get paid as soon as they delivered the load. And FEMA actually sometimes will pay you in advance. But the problem is that typically most owner operators don't have direct FEMA contracts, because FEMA has main contracts with like five large firms. Then those large firms will then create contracts with certain brokerages. Then those brokerages create contracts with certain dispatchers. Then those dispatchers actually get to the owner operators. And then sometimes those owner operators aren't even doing it. They're subbing it to somebody else. So the problem isn't that FEMA takes long to pay. It's that they're so far down the line, by the time the money makes it to them, it's 60 days later.
Right. Right. No, I love that breakdown, man. Yeah, I appreciate you saying that. So that means that you don't really ever hear government contracting needing to be factored. That's not really happening when you are that first tier, is it?
It very rarely. I mean, you can do it, but it's very rarely. Usually you hear factoring with subcontractors.
All right, so we talked about the very beginning, all the stuff that happens before the solicitation, so the pre-solicitation. Then we talked about it being put out for bid, it being awarded, the contract now has mobilized. And now what happens when you've done everything that you said that you're going to do in the contract, and it's time to demobilize? Do you have any like really, really challenging stories that talks about a demobilization effort that just was, very hard, very difficult? Anything like that comes to mind?
Not really. I mean, no, I wouldn't necessarily say, because usually once the job's done and you're getting to demobilization, everybody's pretty much happy, because 9 times out of 10, the government's pretty much paid you in full. You're only waiting on retainage. So everybody's usually like in a good headspace by the time you get to that point, to be honest with you.
Yeah. Okay. Do you factor demobilization into the bid price up front?
Yeah, you can. And typically a lot of times they give you a demob line item or a contract closeout line item. They'll usually put those in there towards the end just to make sure that everything's good. Do people mess up government contracts? Yes, it happens all the time. But the reality is, the government gives you so many opportunities to make it right that you don't hear a lot of horror stories. If you hear horror stories, once again, it's usually somebody who's not direct with it. They're usually second or third tier. They're usually working for a large corporation. And it's just like anything, big bank take little bank. So the big guys are always going to try to take advantage of the small guys. That's when you hear most of your horror stories. Very rarely do you hear a horror story about somebody who had a direct contract with the government.
Gotcha. Okay. And look, we're closing out pretty soon. Only a couple more questions. All right. So demobilization has happened. Everything is smooth. You did what you say you're going to be able to do for that contract. How do you now leverage this experience that you have successfully had with a government contract? Like, how do you highlight it on your capability statement? How do you make sure that this isn't just a one-hit wonder, that you can keep business flowing?
Yeah, you want to make sure that you get a debrief after every contract. You want to make sure that they do a contractor evaluation, that you get a copy of that contractor evaluation. And then also, depending on what agency you're dealing with, you want to make sure that contractor evaluation is posted. That's going to be one of the major things. So you also want to put this not only on your capability statement, but you want to update your SBA DSBS, and you want to put every completed project on your DSBS so that people can search it. You just want to highlight everything. Definitely, like I said, keep your capability statement up to date. Keep your DSBS up to date. Keep your website up to date. You want people to know who you are and the type of work that you're doing.
Okay. No, that's great practical advice right there. And to be honest, I didn't know, with the situation with Was that the GIL, the DSBS, or what you just said? I didn't know that was something that you had to update yourself. That is something that indeed you have to be the one to manage.
Yeah, so the DSBS, you have to update yourself. And in actuality, they just went to a separate, it's not even a part of the GIL anymore. It's its own separate separate system now, the DSBS is, and you have to update it yourself. And I tell people, update it constantly. Make sure it's always accurate, up to date. People think, oh, my SAM is up to date, that's all I need. It's like, no, your DSBS also needs to be up to date.
Gotcha. Okay. I want to say thank you so much for your time tonight, brother. And from here, what can people do to get started with the, government contracting? How can they be a part of your group, the Government Cheese? How can they find you and get more game and be able to use you as a resource?
Yeah. So, of course, across all social media platforms, where there are Government Cheese. So, Instagram, Facebook, also YouTube. I'm building out the YouTube presence now. A lot of free content on YouTube, a lot of stuff to help you just get started. And then once you feel like you're at the point where you're ready to take it to the next level, we do have our course and community with the Government Cheese. It's a great A to Z, everything you would need to know about government contracting, walks you through the whole process. Then our community, what we're trying to build out is a community of government contractors all over the nation. Different industries, different things going on, but somewhere that you can use as a resource that you can go to when you have a project, when you have a need, if you're running short on funding and you might need some help. We want that community to be your one-stop shop where you go to for everything.
No, I love it, man. And again, I truly appreciate your time, because I know you got a lot of things going on. I know that you, again, building a community. I know that people really seek your time and attention to get answers, get questions answered and all that. And for you to join me here, I truly appreciate it. So shout out to Shotty, for connecting us. We have Miss Kelsey Scott. Truly appreciate you for connecting us. You always looking out. But Kev, anything I can do to help, man, just let me know. Anything that you wanted to say before we closed out?
No, I just thank everybody for taking time to jump on and get with us tonight. And if I can be a resource to anybody on this call, if anything you ever need, please reach out. We're here. We're here to help. That's what the community was created for. So we just want to be a resource for you.
Yes, sir. Well, I appreciate that. Everybody, tune in on Wednesday. I'm going to be interviewing a brother who I met at one of these networking events here in the Atlanta area. Interesting thing is, he'll be the first person I interview that has patents. This brother got patents, and these are patents that the likes of Uber Freight and all these major corporations have been using. You know what I mean? So it's pretty dope that I've had an opportunity to meet this brother. He is on a mission to stop the ghost post on the load boards. So all those 30 posts for the one load, just so brokers can get more traction on it, is now his mission to make sure that that's not happening, because it just wastes so much time, everybody's time, when that type of stuff happens. So I'm interested to highlight that brother on Wednesday. So tune in, and of course, next Monday, we're going to get it started again with Freight Waves and their sonar team. So tune in then at 7:30 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. But again, thank you again, Kev, and everybody, be blessed.
Thank you. Have a good one.